From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are drumming up enthusiastic crowds, their populist messages resonating with Americans frustrated with our current political quagmire and with the economy. The populist tradition goes all the way back to President Andrew Jackson. Today we'll look at populism then and now and what the popularity of today's populism tells us about our times. This hour On Point, the history of populism and its resurgence now. You can join us on air or online. Are Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders' messages resonating with you? Do you feel a populist surge? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Laura Meckler. Laura covers politics for The Wall Street Journal. Laura, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the big GOP debate tonight, what are you expecting from the candidates?
I think, again, you know, all eyes will be on Donald Trump. He is still near the top of the polls, although lately Ben Carson has also, another outsider, has also surged to the top of the polls, so I think people will be giving him a lot of attention. People, I think, are going to be looking to see whether they try to sort of take these guys on or and to what extent they are able to push forward their own messages, you know, especially some of the people who are more establishment candidates who are expected to be dominating this race, people like Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, who have really struggled lately.
Right, pushing their own messages, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, but in a very different way. They could not be more different stylistically.
Two of them, that is for sure.
Yeah.
They are, you know, it's hard to even imagine them in the same room, much less the same stage.
So what do you see in each of these men that seems to be working in such opposite ways?
Well, let's think about what they have in common. I mean, what they have in common is that they're not part of the political establishment. Neither one of them has ever held political office. And I think that there's a lot of voters who find that very appealing, the idea of an outsider who's going to sort of not accept what people don't like about Washington, whether those things are, you know, changeable or not is another story. But they, you know, that I think is what sort of is got people excited about these guys.
What about Carly Fiorina? She's seeing increased support as well.
Yeah, she is. She's really kind of like working it. She's working hard. She was her performance at the last debate where she was on at the so-called kids table, the lower polling people,
was widely
praised. She did very well. She's been extremely articulate in voicing her views. She is also, we should note, another outsider, another person who has never held political office before. She comes from the business world. So I think it's interesting that you see all this attention on people who are so outside of the system.
And those more on the inside, the bottom tier candidates, those in single digits at this point, Bobby Jindal, Chris Christie, Rick Santorum. What do you see there?
What do I see in terms of what we're going to expect to hear from them tonight?
Tonight, yeah.
I mean, I think they, you know, they each just have to try to somehow break through. You know, they all have, it's kind of hard to put those guys all into one bucket because they have such a different points of view. Lindsey Graham is really has a message of very hawkish, you know, we need to commit more ground troops and really take on ISIS and doesn't shy away from that in the slightest. Then you have Chris Christie, who has tried to put himself forward as sort of an establishment kind of more person who can attract independent voters, but has obviously struggled in this race to get traction. You have Rick Santorum, who's a real social conservative, and that he rode that quite far in the last campaign, but this time has really just not caught on again. Mm.
And then on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders clearly gaining on Hillary Clinton, her support somewhat softening. What do you make of that? What do you see there?
Well, it's fascinating, really, and that's where I spend most of my time is covering the Democratic race. Bernie Sanders is, you know, ahead of her in New Hampshire, is at least even with her in Iowa, the first two states to vote, and has gained substantially on her in national polls as well. His message, I think it's two things. One, his message is resonating with Democratic voters, I think in a similar way to some extent as the others have. As an outsider, in his case, he has held political office for quite some time. He's been in the Senate and before that in the House. But he's an independent. He's a Democratic socialist. He does not sort of take as a given that we have to make compromises and that we have to kind of work within the system. He calls for a political revolution, and I know we'll be talking about more about that as the show progresses this morning today. But the He is his message is catching on, and at the same time, Hillary Clinton, of course, has had some troubles. She has really, the email story has been a real problem for her, she just had none of her other, she's ruled out all this policy over the summer, and it just, none of it is really getting much attention. It's all being kind of drowned out by these other stories. Hmm.
Laura Meckler, covering politics for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure.
Joining me now from San Francisco, Charles Postol. He is professor of history at San Francisco State University, author of the book The Populist Vision. Charles, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Got a little preview of the GOP debate tonight. We're talking broadly here today about these populist candidates, specifically Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump. There's Laura Meckler saying Bernie Sanders with a political revolution going. Donald Trump thinks, I think, that he's got one of his own. Give us an understanding of this populist movement in American politics.
Well, one place to start, where do we get the name populist? And the name we get populist from, the name comes from the People's Party. It was a nickname for the People's Party of the 1890s. And this party in the 1890s was a farmer labor party that advocated things like the regulation of railroads and banking. It advocated the progressive income tax. It sought to use organization and government to create a more equal society, to overcome the great gaps of wealth and poverty and create economic justice. That's was the most successful third party movement after the Civil War in our history. And it did fail. And when it did fail, its influence it had a very large influence in its after its death. And that the way that worked was many populists went into the socialist movement. They were democratic socialists, and they went into the socialist movement. And that explains why places like Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas were some of the strongest socialist
participants
in the country. And so some of them went into the socialist movement. Many of them went into the farmer labor wings of the Democratic and Republican parties. And that creates the progressive wings of the Republican Party with Robert La Follette, one of the most significant senators in American history, who was a very progressive person who pursued these issues of economic justice through his career. And on the Democratic side, I think the person who I think a useful person to think about would be Lyndon Baines Johnson. His grandfather was a bona fide populist from Central Texas who advocated this type of progressive politics. And Johnson learned those politics in that environment. And that's where I think, you know, we could think of a tradition of the New Deal and even the Civil Rights Act as well.
So this long tradition, this rich tradition in American history, from LBJ to, and we'll go over some of these later, George Wallace, William Jennings Bryan. I mean, a long list. But today with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
Okay.
Yeah,
so let's get to
what are you hearing
right
in them?
The
why them?
Well,
Well,
first thing, I think that one thing we should think about is that Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, I think, really do match the history of that populist movement of the 1890s. I don't know, Elizabeth Warren, of course, is from Oklahoma. I don't know if she claims that type of political root, but it sure sounds like Oklahoma populism to me. And Bernie Sanders is exactly the type of democratic socialist that flocked to the populist movement of the 1890s. And much of his program would make a lot of sense to those people. Now, there's an entirely other political tradition that for a variety of reasons, some social scientists and some journalists describe as populism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a politics that I do think starts in the early 19th century and is associated with people like Andrew Jackson. And that politics is a politics where how do you gain a majority of votes? And one way to gain the majority of votes is you appeal to people's base instincts. It can be race. It can be resentment. It can be, in the case of Andrew Jackson, he's a very wealthy person. He was a Indian hater or an Indian fighter. That was a great part of his reputation. And he also campaigned against elites. Hmm. That's how you get a political majority. Hmm. And I think, someone like George Wallace isn't from the populist tradition. He's from a very long tradition of politicians who scapegoat either African-Americans or immigrants and appeal to the common man against various elites. This is a central part of American political language. Many politicians have done this. There's nothing particularly unique about Donald Trump in this regard. And in my view, there's nothing particularly populist. This is, a very rich man. How does a very rich man get the votes of not rich people, which you need to win elections? You campaign against people stealing their jobs, supposedly, in this case, immigrants, and you campaign against certain types of elites that you're hostile to. This is just classic American politics, and it goes back to Andrew Jackson for sure, but I don't think it has much to do with populism.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour about Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, and the history of populism in America. We're speaking this hour with Charles Postol, author of the book The Populist Vision, and a professor of history at San Francisco State University. And joining me now from Washington is Michael Lind. Michael is co-founder of the New America Foundation, where he is the policy director of the Economic Growth Program. He's the author of many books, including his latest, Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. Michael Lind, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
Let me play some sound here for you. This is at a campaign rally in Boone, Iowa. Last weekend, Republican candidate Donald Trump speaking of his plan for tax reform, striking a very populist tone.
And by the way, my tax plan is going to come out in about 3 or 4 weeks, and we're going to lower taxes, especially for the middle class. We are going to make sure that my friends in the hedge fund business who make a fortune and pay virtually no tax, they are going to start paying taxes. They're going to stop paying taxes. I don't care. You know?
And here is Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, speaking at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia on Tuesday, noting how unfamiliar with wealth he thinks most of the country is.
We live, and I hope all of you know this, in the wealthiest country in the history of the world. But most Americans don't know that, because almost all of that wealth and income is going to the top 1%.
So there's Sanders. The income is going to the top 1%. Donald Trump saying he's going to lower taxes, especially in the middle class. Hedge fund managers, watch out. You're going to start to pay more taxes. Michael Lind, how do you see this? How do you see these two candidates as populists in this race?
Well, I don't. I would distinguish Bernie Sanders' version of social democracy or of labor liberalism from populism in the narrower American sense of Jefferson, Jackson, and I would include William Jennings Bryan populism. The fact that both of these schools want to tax hedge fund managers doesn't mean they're necessarily coming from the same direction. I think Trump is much closer to classic American populism in seeing a mixture of somewhat left-of-center economics with right-of-center values on social issues. We should remember William Jennings Bryan, who was very progressive economically, was also a prohibitionist and prosecuted the Tennessee teacher in the famous Scopes trial for teaching Darwinian evolution. So there's this kind of mix of religious right, economic liberalism, and nativism as well. Anti-immigration sentiment was very strong among the 19th century populists. We got our first the Asian Restriction Acts were supported by labor and populists to restrict immigration from China and other Asian countries in the late 19th century. So this doesn't really fit into conventional left and right categories. Bernie Sanders, on the contrary, is a somewhat more vigorous version of mainstream liberalism.
Well, so then by definition, do I hear you say that populism tends to be a mashup of positions from the left and the right? Is that what we're seeing here?
Well, that's my interpretation. I think it's a coherent position. And I explained in a recent Politico article, I think the moral vision is one that pits producers who can be rich or poor or middle class against parasites or freeloaders who can belong to any class. And so I'm from Central Texas. One of the Texas populists' mottos, the enemy was tramps and millionaires. So in other words, it's the idle rich and the idle poor. And this really does not map onto class warfare. It's more the virtuous, hardworking people, whatever class they belong to people taking advantage of the government, whether they are bankers getting bailouts or illegal immigrants. Mm.
Let's get a call in here, Anthony, in Columbus, Ohio. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, your guest in his characterization, I think, is he's different. The historian is different from, I think, what you often hear in our press, and that is that there is a sort of rough equivalency between these two men. So therefore, it's like there's a kind of extremism on the left and represented by Sanders and extremism on the right that is represented by Donald Trump. And I don't, you know, somebody who studies history myself, I don't see this. I think that what in many ways what Donald Trump represents is a xenophobia that is, you know, has a kind of central place, right, in American history. And that, you know, is still very strong with us today. Well, what Bernie Sanders represents is, in a way, something that has been, he talks in a language that was destroyed by the Cold War, really. A language that, that would get you associated during the Cold War era with communism. Anything kind of vaguely leftist. And so in the United States today, I feel like there really is no left in any kind of meaningful way, but we have a media, we have a press that insists that there is one. So there is this kind of insistence on the existence of something that does not exist, that is a meaningful left, while at the same time there's a denial of something else, and that is, and I'm going to use the word fascism, and I don't mean this just to be pejorative toward Mr. Trump, that if you look at look at a political dictionary or encyclopedia and look up a kind of definition, a standard definition of fascism, that what that man, what Donald Trump says and the way that he says it and the way that he presents himself kind of maps, you know, very well onto a kind of standard definition of fascism.
All right, Anthony, let me turn Michael Lind onto your comment. What do you say, Michael?
Well, I agree and disagree with your caller. I think fascism died in 1945. It was a peculiar interwar European phenomenon, and I don't think it's helpful describing anything after 1945, including in Latin America or Asia, as fascist. But your caller is quite correct that the media is making this false symmetry between Trump and Sanders and the center of the Democratic and Republican parties. In fact, Sanders and Clinton agree on far more than they disagree. Whereas if you look at Trump, he's actually challenging the fundamental orthodoxy of conservative republicanism since Reagan by challenging tax cuts for the rich and cuts in entitlements like Social Security and Medicare. He has rejected both of those as part of his program while going along with the anti-immigration, some of the social conservatism, not all of it, on the social issues. So Trump is offering a radical alternative to Republican orthodoxy. Sanders is offering a somewhat more muscular, beefed up liberalism on steroids.
Let's get Charles Postol back in here and go through some of the history of some of these populists in this country. We mentioned William Jennings Bryan. Here's some sound. Originally delivered his Cross of the Gold speech at the Democratic National Convention on July 8th, 1896. It is thought of as one of the most effective speeches ever delivered at a national convention. He later recorded the speech in a studio, and we have a clip of it here.
Out there where they have erected schoolhouses for the education of the young, churches where they praise their creator, and cemeteries where rest the ashes of their dead, these people, we say, are as deserving of the consideration of our party as any people in this country. It is for these that we speak. We do not come as aggressors. Our war is not a war of conquest. We are fighting in defense of our homes, our families, and posterity.
Charles Postol, Brian ran for president 3 times on a populist agenda. Right. How did he carry the banner of populism?
Well, he was a great speaker, and people loved to hear him speak. He also had the populist party did endorse him in 1896 for president. He was a Democrat. He was never a populist, but he supported some populist causes, and the populists endorsed him. And in many ways, in his career in the 1890s, he sounded a lot like a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Mm. It would be very difficult to pin either a xenophobic or that type of politics on him. The real xenophobic party at that time, of course, was the Republican Party, the anti-immigrant party.
That's not the case.
It's absolutely the case. That's absolutely the case. The Populist Party was one of its most striking features in the 1890s. There was a Great Depression. And one of the most striking features of the Populist Party of the 1890s is instead of scapegoating immigrants or scapegoating African Americans, one of the most striking features of the Populist Party of the 1890s was it said the solution to this problem is governmental intervention in providing stimulus to the economy and providing jobs for those who needed work. And so this tradition that Brian was part of is, I think, exactly what we're seeing in the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders tradition. Their rhetoric was similar. Their organization was similar.
And Michael Lind, how do you disagree with that, Michael?
Yes, I do. With all due respect to Professor Postol, I think he's trying to make William Jennings Bryan into a modern liberal Democrat rather than a man of his time. The populists did not agitate against the Asian Immigration Acts, which were a racist immigration exclusion supported by most white Americans, including most of white organized labor at the time. William McKinley championed federal civil rights for blacks. At a time when, after Reconstruction, when the Southern states, the basis of much of the populist movement, Bryan avoided challenging Southern white supremacy. And last but not least, William Jennings Bryan was a figure of the religious right in his creationism, anti-Darwinism.
This is a mashup of history that just doesn't – it just doesn't make sense. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt also failed to confront – the Southern racist wing of his party. But that doesn't mean that Roosevelt is characterized by a particular – we wouldn't call the Roosevelt administration a particularly racist one. It accommodated the racists. And I think the populists should be thought of as precisely as the predecessors of modern liberalism. Mm. That's precisely what they were.
But it was the Republican Party at the time, not the Democratic Party of William Jennings Bryan, that was pushing the force bill in the 1890s. That was federal civil rights legislation opposed by Bryan's party.
Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate the history lesson. I'm going to say I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll continue it later. Let's get back to what we're speaking here with Sam in Everett, Washington, Massachusetts. Everett, Massachusetts. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Fantastic subject, very timely. I'd like to take a swipe at an organizing principle for a populist vision, and that would be that the kind of, when I think of populism, and particularly the roots of it in the Farmers Alliance, which maybe your guests could talk about, I think the organizing principle was a recognition that concentrated capital was the enemy of democracy, and in particular the enemy of the common man. And that was a sentiment of the Farmers Alliance. They understood that. That's why they organized to form co-ops to try to counteract the corrupting influence of banks and railroads. It's something that the late Justice Brandeis, pointed out, that you can't have democracy and such concentrated capital. Not just wealth, but capital in particular, the power of banks, the power of people that have their hands on the levers and dials of capital assets. Hmm. And I think that's the organizing principle that I would recommend for populism and the roots in the Farmers Alliance. And I would say Bernie Sanders preaches that vision, And Donald Trump is antithetical to that.
Sam, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Jason in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Jason. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hey, I just want to say that the most perfect dialectic for American politics today has to be Bernie Sanders versus Rand Paul. Was it socialized democracy versus libertarianism? The potentials of that dialectic is just absolutely beautiful, and I would absolutely love to see that come to the forefront. I mean, you know, in the history of the populist movement, of course, you can't discount Ron Paul and what happened with the Republican Party, you know, I guess starting in 2008 when he came on the scene. So you definitely can't discount libertarianism and socialized democracy. But I think, and just as far as Donald Trump, he's some kind of weird backlash between establishment politics and the Tea Party phenomenon. So that's it. Thank you.
Jason, thank you. Let me play some sound here. This is Bernie Sanders speaking at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia on Tuesday, exclaiming in populist rhetoric what he thinks is unjust about the spread of wealth in America.
There is no justice, and I want you to hear this clearly. When the top one-tenth of 1%, not 1%, the top one-tenth of 1%, today in America owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And in your hearts, you will have to determine the morality of that and the justice of that.
And here's Hillary Clinton speaking to supporters at New York University in July, outlining her plans to bring income back to the middle class, a very populist sentiment.
My mission from my first day as president to the last will be to raise the incomes of hardworking Americans so they can once again afford a middle class life. We need to end the wage stagnation that's holding back our families and holding back our country.
Michael Lynn, do you see Hillary Clinton adopting some of this rhetoric?
Oh, I think you do. I think that if you compare Hillary Clinton to former President Bill Clinton in the 1990s, there's been a real leftward shift among mainstream Democrats. And in the case of Britain, where you had the somewhat related Tony Blair New Labor, the equivalent of America's New Democrats, they've been obliterated by Jeremy Corbyn in this shock election in the last week. So I think that there's a general perception, even among moderate to conservative establishment Democrats, that this vision of 1990s neoliberalism, that if you just deregulate everything and then equip people with more skills and more higher education, everything will work out fine, is not working, that there are structural problems with the not only with growth, but with distribution. And that plays into traditional liberals like Sanders.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and the history of populism in America this hour, and you can join the conversation. What do today's populist candidates say about the time we're living in? We're speaking this hour with Charles Postol, author of the book The Populist Vision and a professor of history at San Francisco State University, and Michael Lind, author of the book Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. He's co-founder of the New America Foundation. Here's some sound Monday Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump speaking at a rally in Dallas, Texas, where he reinforced his tough stance on immigration.
We have to build a wall, folks. We have to build a wall. And a wall works. All you have to do is go to Israel, say, how's your wall working? Walls work. And I want people to come into the country, but I want them to be legal. I want them to go through the process. I want them to come in. I want to have a big, beautiful door, but they have to be legal.
Iona on Facebook says, doesn't the populism have to be authentic to count? How does populism focus on regular people match with the extremely wealthy businessmen who calls America, quote, a dumping ground for immigrants, forgetting somehow that his own dumped German grandparents on his father's side laid the foundation for the Donald's own prosperity? Let's get Jim in here from Syracuse, New York. Jim, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
You know, real quick here, you know, one thing I don't hear all the time when I listen to these types of programs is the love of the country. You know, what Donald Trump is in his heart, the one thing he's saying he's drawing people in is he's bringing back the love of this country. You know, as a working class guy who gets up every day and earns his money, I'm sick and tired of being told there's something wrong with me because of something that happened 200 years ago, i.e. racism or i.e. this or that. This is the United States of America. It's the greatest country in the world. And I want to hear that from my candidates. The very fact that someone like Hillary Clinton or Sanders should be running for president, I think is a disgrace. Okay. Whatever Donald Trump is, and I'm not saying he's the end all. I'm not saying he's the next great hope, but he's saying the things that are going to elevate this country and bring it back to its once great greatness. Because I think whatever we do or believe or agree in this country's in trouble. We're in serious trouble. Our police are being killed in the streets. Our morals and values are being destroyed. It's time for someone to take this country back.
And you believe that's Trump, Jim. Thank you. I'm so glad you called. Good to hear your voice on this. Let's get to Alexander in Boston. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to reiterate a previous caller's point about the diametric between Bernie Sanders and Rand Paul, and I think that was a beautiful point that was spoken about before. Totally agree with what was said there. And so my point gets to the resonating of both Sanders and Mr. Trump with, I would say, more of a youthful base when you talk about the populism and where that resonates. I'm 22, kind of more center-right in my beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I see, coming from a Latino neighborhood, I'm kind of on the other side of where a lot of people would consider themselves politically. And there, I would definitely say that there is a large support base for Mr. Sanders. I don't particularly understand it. I'm very much opposed to the viewpoints that he has. But I can see why, when you talk about the populist standpoint, that would be so, that would echo a lot with the Latino community, because a lot of people do want the things that he's preaching at. Hmm. However, that being said, I also take a stand on the side of more of an objectivist philosophy where you work hard for what you get, and simply handing things out isn't going to be the end solution. And so that's where I stand, and I just want to add my two cents on it.
I'm glad you did. Alexander, thank you. Thank you very much. Much like Bernie Sanders, the populist Huey Long proposed new wealth distribution measures in the 1930s. Here's some sound. Here he is delivering his pitch for his Share Our Wealth program in Washington, D.C. This is 1934, his plan to redistribute wealth to curb poverty and homelessness after the Depression had this motto. It was called Every Man a King.
It is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America, and that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat?
You hear similarities there between Huey Long and what we're hearing today, Charles Postol?
I do hear similarities. Huey Long was tremendously popular. His Share of the Wealth was tremendously popular. He tended to be something of an autocrat and accumulated a lot of power in his own hands in Louisiana and Louisiana politics, and created enemies, and of course was gunned down as a result of that and was assassinated. But in that context, but in the Great Depression, there was this feeling of of that the common man, the working class, was not getting a fair shake, and Huey Long spoke forcefully for that. And I think in many ways it sounds a lot like a Bernie Sanders speech, and I think the parallels are clear.
And then there was Ross Perot. In 1992, he ran as an independent candidate for president. His popularity was as a result of his populist resentment to the establishment. Here he is in February 1992 on an interview on Larry King on CNN saying he would campaign for president if ordinary people wanted him to.
If you're that serious, you, the people, are that serious, you register me in 50 states. And if you're not willing to organize and do that, then this is all just talk.
Wait, Larry.
Are you saying, I'm playing to the ordinary folks. If you're dead serious,
start committees.
I want to see some sweat. I want to see some sweat. Why do I want to see some sweat? I said it earlier. I want you in the ring.
Charles, do populists ever win? I mean, there's Ross Perot. He didn't. I mean, third party, he got somewhere, but he didn't get all the way to the top. You know, do populists win?
Well, I guess there are two questions there. One is, do populists win? And I wouldn't put Ross Perot as a populist. He was a millionaire who threw his hat into the political ring, and he had this sort of nationalistic politics that had a base and had a popularity. I differentiate between popular and populist, and he was popular. It's very, very hard to win as a third party in the United States. The institutional structure makes third party candidates very difficult, and that's why the People's Party, the Populist Party of the 1890s, collapsed. It could not survive. Even though it had a large voter base, it wasn't big enough to supplant one of the other major parties, which you need to do. And so a third party is very difficult. I think a politician with popular politics in this regard, I think we have seen people, I think that, yes, from the time of Andrew Jackson, we have had this type of nationalist and sometimes racist politicians can be very successful. You know, we should think about what Ronald Reagan sounded like in 1980. For a lot of us, observing at that time when he was campaigning against welfare queens and similar type of rhetoric, and he was very successful politician. He didn't do it as a third party. He did it within the Republican Party. But the parallels between a Trump and a Reagan, I think, are much clearer. If you think about it, than we usually do. Reagan had his own standing up for the common man against liberal elites and welfare queens, and it was very effective.
Let's get Dan in here in Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Yes. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Great job standing in for Tom, by the way.
Thank you.
I would like to sort of remind your listeners what great historian Richard Hofstadter said many years ago in the 50s, I think, is sort of a great clinical anthropologist looking back on the age of reform in the United States. And he talked about the utopian streak in populism, and I would like to sort of expand that for the modern era. He made the distinctions between liberal progressive wing of populism and the sort of Christian conservative wing of populism. And Hofstadter basically said that, you know, the difference is that the liberal progressives, for the liberal progressives, their utopia lies somewhere in the future, and for the conservative populists, their utopia lies somewhere in the past.
Hmm.
And in a way, they're sort of two sides of the same populist coin. One looks forward and one looks backward. And I don't think you can really see any clearer demonstration of that than with Bernie Sanders versus, you know, a lot of the Republican field looking back toward as we've heard from your listeners too, looking back toward a better time in America. The sad thing about the latter view is that you can't go back there again. We kind of are compelled to move forward, and so I'm not sure that this round the conservative populist side of that coin is going to be successful.
Such an interesting way to look at it. Dan, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Tennessee, Clarksville, Tennessee. James is on the line. James, welcome to the program.
Well, I think that the populist message is something that needs to be addressed for the simple reason that you have people on socialist programs in which they're calculating their income to be about $17,000 before they even give any aid without even looking at any of the costs of the individuals. Those programs are taxed because people do not make enough money to even make their basic ends meet on the incomes they're working for 40 hours a week. I think that maybe the only way to really correct this issue is maybe to limit wealth instead of allowing individuals to own enough money to support small countries while people are struggling so hard just to feed their children.
So who do you support in this race, James?
I'm kind of open because I'm waiting to see what's going on, but I think that right now Clinton is very strong because of her desires to see people's more social issues within the nation be addressed. Mm.
James, thanks so much for the call. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Got to get a few more in here. James in, Adam in Council Bluff, Iowa. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hey, Jane, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, my comment was, you know, I live here in Iowa, so I see a lot of the campaigns coming through my town a lot, and I hear a lot of the different messages, but what I don't hear is how exactly they expect a president and a democracy to take on all this power. I don't hear them say how they're going to work with Congress to make this work. So my question to the guests on your show is how does a populist president get his message across to Congress?
Adam, thank you. Michael Lind, what do you say?
Well, that's been one of the weaknesses of populism because you have to have a majority party that controls Congress. Even if you have a like-minded president, in order for major historic legislative reforms to be undertaken. Now, where populists have succeeded, as some of the Bryan generation and then later the Huey Long generation, they can pressure the mainstream parties to adopt some of their issues. So, for example, federal deposit insurance was an old 1880s, 1890s populist proposal, and it was finally adopted, like many other populist proposals, during the New Deal in the 1930s, and there are other examples of this. What I think is the basic vision of American populism, which is a society of small producers without large concentrations of capital, either in banking or industry, they've succeeded. They've failed in that since the growth of large corporations and large banks in the late 19th century, and I think they will continue to fail. So I think that populists can sometimes get specific reforms they want, but it's very unlikely we're going to go back to a decentralized society of small producers in the lifetime of anyone listening.
Would you consider the Tea Party a populist movement, Michael Lind?
Yes, I would. My own definition of populist may be different from others. That is, it's a combination of economic liberalism on many issues with what's considered social conservatism on other issues. And if you look at polls of the Tea Party from 2009, 2010 onwards, they did not fit the standard free market conservative model. I'm not talking about their leaders. I'm just talking about people who were self-identified. They wanted Social Security and Medicare to be preserved or increased. And at the same time, they have very restrictionist views on immigration. And so I think you have to see the Tea Party as part of a wave of what's called national populist movements on both sides of the Atlantic, including the UK Independence Party in Britain, Marine Le Pen's National Front. There are more liberal versions of populism, but I don't think you can simply dismiss right-wing populism as not really being populist.
Charles, do you see the Tea Party as a precursor to what we're looking at today in the Republican Party?
Well, the Tea Party is a complex phenomenon, but to me, one of the significant pieces of it was the extent that it accepted the corporate agenda of deregulating banking, cutting taxes at the top rates. The original demands and complaints of the Tea Party really focused on a corporate agenda that the Koch brothers and other top billionaires were funding and supporting. And it's a free market fundamentalism that was been developing in American politics since the Reagan administration and before. And in that sense, it was part of a long conservative tradition. I think we should call something like the Tea Party a conservative movement. They call themselves a conservative movement, and I think that is a conservative movement. And the right way to think about it is a conservative phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Now, within that, I agree with Michael that there is this very strange dynamic that, for example, in the slogan, keep government off of my Medicare. There's this strange idea of one, anti-government feelings, which correspond to this corporate conservative ideas. Plus, we want our Medicare, which, of course, is a government program. And I think in that sense, I agree with Michael that what we're seeing with the Trump phenomenon is that many of these people who support the Tea Party are not so on board with the corporate agenda of cutting Medicare, cutting Social Security, and cutting tax rates for the corporations and for the wealthiest Americans. In that sense, I think the Trump thing is very important in terms of breaking up this corporate consensus within the conservative movement.
Well, thanks to both of you for helping us understand this movement, the history of populism. Charles Postol, professor of history at San Francisco State. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you.
And Michael Lynn, policy director at the New America Foundation. Really appreciate your time, Michael. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.